Hubert Humphrey is pitching his major efforts these days at winning New York's crucial 43 electoral votes. The vice president made his third appearance here today in the last 2 weeks. His first stop was the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, where he met with 200 local Democratic leaders. Humphrey warned them there'll be a Republican in the White House unless they get to work in the final 2 weeks of this campaign. He got a lot of applause and shouts of encouragement from the Democratic leaders. But his reception at Herald Square later in the day was a different story. Richard Townley reports.
For his appearance, the vice president picked a busy location at its busiest moment of the day in an apparent hope of getting the biggest crowd possible. And it worked. Herald Square was jammed with midday traffic, and if the audience of the faithful and the curious was not overwhelmed with enthusiasm, it was at least polite. A rock group tried to liven up the scene with a campaign song based on the gospel tune, "Give Me That Old Time Religion." And when Humphrey mounted the platform, it was with the evangelical zeal that has marked his stretch drive for the presidency.
14 shopping days to election day. I hope Macy's understand that. 14 shopping days. And on election day, I predict not a miracle on 34th Street, but a Democratic miracle on Main Street all across the United States.
Humphrey said nothing really new. Street corner rhetoric is usually just that, street corner rhetoric. But he seemed enthusiastic about his response after the speech when I talked to him.
Are you pleased with the reception you got here today, Mr. Vice President?
Beautiful, marvelous reception, wonderful crowd.
You think it's on the upswing?
Positively, boys, positively. Save your money and buy your wife a new dress. We're going to the inaugural.
Thank you, sir.
The Humphrey appearance had the appearance of a successful rally. There were plenty of New York Democrats on the stand. There were celebrities like actor Shelley Winters, rock and roll singer Chubby Checkers, dancing and singing to "Give Me That Vote for Hubert Humphrey." It remains to be seen if the enthusiasm was real or imagined. Richard Townley, Metro Media News.
Who can we trust that will help make this, keep this country prosperous? That will help keep jobs, that will help take care of our elderly, that will help provide for our children for an education? Who can we trust? Well, I don't think the people are going to trust the old Nixon, or the new Nixon, or the real Nixon, or LeMay, or Agnew, or Wallace, because the people remember what happened the last time they put some trust in them.
To a reporter who's just spent the last 4 weeks with Richard Nixon, there are times when it almost seems as though Hubert Humphrey had carefully analyzed the presidential campaign of 1960, and then for some perverse reason had decided to pattern his bid for the presidency on Nixon's losing effort. Humphrey is running at a pace that would have decimated the Green Bay Packers in their prime. Nixon pushed himself the same way in 1960, but he's learned from his own mistakes. The sharpest contrast between the Humphrey and Nixon campaigns is to be found in terms of organization. Nixon's campaign has it, Humphrey's doesn't. Or if it does, every effort is being made to camouflage it. Schedules on the Humphrey campaign bear a certain resemblance to the Easter Bunny. No one over the age of consent has any business believing in either one. Clocks are a vital part of Nixon's campaign. They are a living reprimand to Humphrey's. And yet, a certain recognizable form is emerging out of the chaos of the past few weeks. When a Republican seeks wide national support, he issues a bland, broad-based, nonpartisan appeal. That has been Richard Nixon's approach. A Democrat in trouble, like Hubert Humphrey, wraps himself in the party banner and seeks haven in the traditional Democratic strongholds. Among the workers, the elderly, and the minority groups, Hubert Humphrey is a man reborn, the prodigal son come home. In this environment, Humphrey himself is curiously touching, and the prospect of his victory becomes almost feasible.
What are you doing?
The visible support for Hubert Humphrey, even here in the heart of New York City, is something less than overpowering. But apparently, Mr. Humphrey now believes that when those people and millions of other Democrats like them go to the polls, they will decide, after all, that Hubert Humphrey is their last best hope, if only by process of elimination. This is Ted Koppel, ABC News, with the Humphrey campaign in New York.
The Gallup poll to be published tomorrow will show that Richard Nixon still is well ahead in the national popular vote, but that Hubert Humphrey is now 3 percentage points closer to Nixon than in the poll released on October 10th. The new poll gives Nixon 43%, Humphrey 31%, Wallace 20%, with 6% undecided. The October 10th poll gave Nixon 44%, Humphrey 29%, Wallace 20%, unchanged, with 7% undecided. So there seems to be a wide divergence between the Gallup and the Harris polls. The most recent Lewis Harris poll, made from October 8th to October 10th, gave Nixon 40%, Humphrey 35%, Wallace 18%, with 7% undecided. So although Gallup shows Nixon still way out in front, Harris says if Humphrey gains another 2 or 3 points, the election could become too close to call.
Vice President Humphrey campaigned in New York City today. It was his fourth visit to the state in 11 days and reflects his concern over the close race for the state's 43 electoral votes. Contributing editor Jack Perkins has been covering the Humphrey campaign, and here is his report.
Humphrey said today he has a distance to go, but he's driving himself like a sprinter. He spoke in New York's Herald Square this noon. He was pushing himself. Both his voice and his rhetoric were strained.
Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are, wherever you're standing, let's get...
You know, Mr. Nixon and his Republican friends, they've got a new slogan. And imagine them having this slogan about forgotten Americans. Well, they ought to know they forgot them plenty of times. They forgot our parents. They forgot our grandparents. When the Nixon Republicans fought Medicare, fought Social Security, when Mr. Nixon said it wouldn't work, a man that didn't know that much surely doesn't know enough to be president of the United States.
Hubert Humphrey today began the final 2 weeks of Campaign 68 by concentrating on New York's 43 electoral votes. One event on his full day's schedule was a rally in Manhattan's Herald Square. John Hart reports.
Hubert Humphrey is spending this week half of his remaining campaign in only 3 states, but they are big electoral states where, by all indicators, he trails Richard Nixon. New York, where he's close behind, Texas, close behind, and California, way behind. But Humphrey these days is in the throes of optimism.
And on election day, I predict not a miracle on 34th Street, but a Democratic miracle on Main Street all across the United States. And why do I make this prediction? Because I think the central question that needs to be asked is, who do we trust in this country of ours to lead America in the next 4 years? Who can we trust that will help make this, keep this country prosperous, that will help keep jobs, that will help take care of our elderly, that will help provide for our children for an education? Who can we trust? And I want to say to my business friends, that you, it's all right for you to say you're a Republican. I understand that. Goes over good in social circles. Sometimes it makes you feel better. But I want to tell you, if you want to live like a Republican, you better vote Democratic. That's the way to live like one. Great.
As Hubert Humphrey likes to say, there are 14 more shopping days for getting a president. And when it's upswing against frontrunner, that fact may be bigger now than any issue. John Hart, CBS News, with the Humphrey campaign, Herald Square, New York.
Before he went to California, Walter Cronkite prepared the following political report, the first of a series on the candidates and the issues.
In campaign 68, as in all others of the past, The issues and where the candidates stand on them often become blurred in the day-to-day reports of campaign activity across the nation. This year, in the absence of televised debates, on the CBS Evening News, we will attempt to clarify this vital area of the presidential race with a series of special reports. Now, these reports are not a debate, perhaps but a poor substitute for debates with their opportunity for cross-examination. But this, at least, we hope, will be a cataloging of where the candidates stand on the issues. Hubert Humphrey on October 9th and George Wallace on October 16th replied on film to our questions. Richard Nixon declined because he did not want to share a forum with Wallace. But Nixon's campaign organization made available videotape recordings of his campaign statements of his positions. Tonight, the first report deals with a major issue of 1968. The words law and order are figuring prominently in this campaign. Is this issue racist?
I reject a fashionable term that is used by some of our friends in the press and commentators and some political observers to the effect that law and order is a code word for racism. I don't buy that at all. I've talked to a lot of my friends in the black community, and they want law and order. They are the ones, the fear stalks the ghettos as well as the suburbs. They are the ones that suffer the most from organized crime, the numbers, the rackets, and all the other things that happen. And I would say that as far as that's concerned, when you say that law and order, you didn't, but when people say that law and order is a code word for racism, what they're doing is condemning, in effect, the whole Negro community and saying, in effect, they're the ones that are breaking the law. And that just isn't true.
Well, of course, there are those in certain portions of the news media and those who run against me that try to equate our stand with law and order with racism. But it's a sad day in our country when you cannot speak out against the destruction of cities, burning, looting, arson, and murder by a few. And I'm not talking about race, because the overwhelming majority of people of all races in this country are against this breakdown of law and order. But it's a sad day when you cannot talk about stopping such actions as that in the country without some liberal left-winger charging you with being a racist. I'm sick of it, and the American people are sick of it, and it's going to be stopped.
I'm sure that those who have done the most talking about law and order and have made it the central issue have included within that racial overtones and undertones. Don't think there's any doubt about it. We've been confronted in this nation for a long time with a rising rate of organized crime and of street crime. Much of it, by the way, regrettably, is attributable to young people, most of it. In fact, for the past 3 or 4 years, I recall that there has been no increase in adult crime. But there has been, and there has been an increase in what we call street crime and violence, riots. Now, the riots generally involve the black people. And when you talk about law and order, as the third party candidate does, and frequently as the Republican candidate does, I think that a good deal of the emphasis is upon the riot situation. As they say, the looting and the burning and the arson and the sniping, all that comes in what we call the riot situation. There's been a lot of talk about law and order, and I'm prepared to talk about it too, because I think I know what we can do about it and what we need to do about it. There's never been any law enforced through demagoguery. There's never been a riot that's been subdued or suppressed through campaign oratory. It takes a great deal more than just that.
Is the issue of law and order one for local governments or something the federal government should be concerned with?
I do not want the federal government setting up a police force which will move its tentacles out across the country into local law enforcement problems, because the problems differ in different cities, and I believe that the closer that responsibility can be to the people, the better. What I did refer to, however, is the setting up first of a national council on law enforcement, in which we have the Attorney General and the other cabinet officers who have anything to do with law enforcement working on this problem constantly, just as the National Security Council operates on foreign policy problems and as the Board of Economic Advisors operates on economic problems. Second, as far as the training of people are concerned, what I am recommending here is a national academy for the training of officers. And I believe that by raising the level of training through this national academy, it will have a remarkable effect on raising the level of not only quality of those serving in police forces, but also eventually their pay. What we have to get down to here is this. It's a question of pay, it's a question of training, it's a question of quality.
Now, Mr. Nixon recommended a four-point program. One of the points, he wanted to have a cabinet committee, a cabinet-level committee. We already have that. A second one, that's 2 years old, that's been functioning. Secondly, he wanted a coordination, a center of information to coordinate information on crime. We already have that. That's been going on for some time. The third thing he recommended was a federal institute for training officers, of police officers. We already have that. Mr. J. Edgar Hoover must have been surprised to hear Mr. Nixon say that, because the FBI has been training police officers and has gone into it in a much more extensive way in recent years than ever before. Now, I, as president, would recommend a much larger investment on the part of the federal government in law enforcement, in police, giving block grants to cities for police salaries, for equipment. Now, it can be done, but as John Kennedy once said, peace and freedom are not cheap. And my friend, law and order are not cheap, but crime is more expensive. And the only way that I know to improve law and order and law enforcement in this country is to give the police the tools to do the job.
Well, the first thing they can do is to seek indictments against those at the federal who violate federal statutes of crossing state lines to bring about a riot, who engage in seditious activities of organizing and plotting to overthrow the government. And there's many much documentary evidence that this is the case. They ought to seek out these people, those who stand up and say, let us destroy this city, and then wind up the week after that in Hanoi. There is a connection, and the Attorney General of our nation, instead of apologizing for this group of militants and activists who want to destroy our society, ought to go before grand jurors and get them indicted and then prosecute them to the full extent of the law and stick a few of them under jail and get them off the public. And when I become the president, I'm going to have my attorney general to do just that. I'm sick of people that sit down and plot to overthrow the government, plot to destroy a city, cross state lines to create a riot, and the attorney general of our country sits back and spends all of his time busing school children in Los Angeles or Chicago. No wonder the country has come to a sad state of affairs, and we have anarchy prevailing in our streets. I would also ask the Congress to change some of the decisions of the court that have handcuffed the police. I would make Washington a model city, regardless of what it took, of peace and tranquility. I would speak out as president in support of the police and firemen of the country. And if I'm elected president, I will carry enough congressional districts and states and cities that is going to put some backbone in many mayors and governors who themselves have handcuffed the police in enforcing the law. And in my judgment, that will help bring about a restoration of law and order in the country.
Our next report will deal with the problems of the cities.
Vice President Humphrey remains, by any basis of measurement available, a complete underdog. Vice President Humphrey remains.